Welcome to Bergonomics, demystifying economics with Ross McDowell.
Welcome to the second part of the Bergonomics podcast on blockchain and cryptocurrency. Today, RMIT's Blockchain Innovation Hub co-director, distinguished Professor Jason Potts, discusses how cryptocurrency is mined and the enormous amount of skepticism directed toward cryptocurrencies. Now, I want to get on to crypto and digital currencies. First of all, I want to read you a couple of opposing thoughts about them. So, cryptocurrency is valued at, in Australian dollars, $2.8 trillion. It's larger than the GDP of Italy or Canada. Venture capital investment in digital assets and blockchain has increased in the last 12 months from $5.5 billion to $17 billion. There are 8,000 cryptocurrencies, according to the US Federal Reserve, and the usage of those currencies has increased from $66 million users to 221 million users in 12 months. The famed S&P company, the Dow Jones Indices, which measures all sorts of different investment equity future indexes, now have given cryptocurrencies instant credibility by also providing an index for that. El Salvador has just made Bitcoin legal tender. So if you go into a McDonald's to buy a Big Mac, they must accept that as legal tender. That's one side of it. Now, here's a quote from a crypto skeptic software engineer, Stephen Deal, who says, crypto is essentially an economic cult that taps into very base human instincts of fear, greed, and tribalism, combined with economic illiteracy as a means to recruit more greater fools to pile money into what looks like a weird, novel, digital variant of a pyramid scheme. It is truly difficult to see where the self-aware scams, true believers, and performance art begin and end. Now, they're two very different viewpoints, aren't they? With a whole lot of very trusted organizations giving cryptocurrency the nod of approval, and other people believing it's another tulip scheme.
Yeah. I don't think those are different perspectives at all. I just think they're just describing two aspects of the same thing, which is a very, very early stage technology that is highly experimental, that has attracted scammers, just as all new technologies do. That is has a lot of uncertainty around it. We're still not really sure what we're going to use all of these things for. Some of the use cases are kind of ridiculous. Some of them are profound. All new technologies look ridiculous because there's a process that we go through that often takes decades to figure out how are we going to use it? What are the vulnerabilities? What are the unintended consequences? What are the things that this disrupts and displaces that we no longer need to use anymore? There's always resistance with any new technology because new technologies aren't born into a pristine world. They displace other technologies, and other technologies will have vested interests and people that have put time and effort and capital into those. So new technologies always have enemies. That's the first point. It's not a unique thing of cryptocurrency. All technologies.
Who you believe are the vested interests wanting or not wanting cryptocurrency. But before we do that, can you please explain what's a mined coin and what's a stable coin, the difference between them?
So there's there's many ways in which a blockchain produces consensus. The first way that was invented by Satoshi Nakamoto was the proof of work consensus mechanism. Mining refers to the process by which computers run the protocol. They basically burn through computer work cycles in order to provide security and are rewarded with the native token. That's what mining is. So mining is just basically the computers just grinding away, performing calculations in order to provide security to the network and are being rewarded with the crypto token. That's what mining is. So this is vast server farms. Electricity goes in, compute is done. At the back end of it comes the security of the network. So the Bitcoin network is a phenomenally secure network. If it wasn't secure, there's almost $1 trillion that you can take if you can hack it and break it. Right? So mining is providing a service. It's providing security in the same way that banks provide security by having walls and vaults and laws and other ways of protecting your money. Cryptocurrencies provide security by just having all of the nodes or computers that are running the protocol perform these operations to check everyone's work, to make sure that no one's trying to double spend or trying to pass fake transactions. That's what security looks like there. So mining is that operation. Yeah.
So on a mining coin, is the value of the coin that pops out of the end of the computational process, does it have any inherent value as related to the cost to mine it? Or is it purely related to the laws of supply and demand according to how many of these coins are there?
Yeah, so the latter. These are pure market objects. No one is forced to use them. Their value is entirely determined by the market. If people are using them and demanding them, that's what creates value. So in the beginning, Bitcoin was worth nothing. Then someone used it to buy a pizza. And then it was worth, the exchange rate was 10,000 Bitcoins bought you two pizzas. Today, you could... Apologies for that. Today, you could use one Bitcoin will buy you, many, many thousands of pizzas, right? Possibly an entire pizza franchise.
$85,000 worth of pizza.
Yeah. So the point is, it's market determined value. Like so, in that sense. But the question of mining is actually the value of mining is proportional to the value of the coin. Because you're being paid in the coin. So with the Bitcoin operation, there's thousands and thousands of mining rigs around the world. Each of those is burning a predictable amount of electricity. So they know how much the cost of mining is. They'll switch those rigs on or off depending upon the price of the Bitcoin, because there's a known probability of getting a Bitcoin if you run a mining rig. A single rig might produce one Bitcoin a year, that's say $85,000, but it might cost $35,000 worth of electricity to produce that. So it's still profitable. So you've got that running on. But if Bitcoin price was only $30,000, it's not worth it. So I switch that off. I switch the rig off, there's less security in the network. So there's a positive feedback between the value of the coin and the number of computers that come in to do mining. So with Bitcoin, you or I can mine. Anyone's allowed to do it. You just download the software, you fire up your computer, and now it's mining. So the number of mining rigs that are pulled into the network is proportional to the amount to the value of the coins.
Okay. So traditionally, through currencies, they used to be backed by gold, which gave them a value. We've moved away from that now. Currencies are also given value via exchange rate mechanisms around the world. They go up and down in value. And that's based on supposedly logical explanations of economic activity. But with a Bitcoin or cryptocurrency, a mined coin, they vary wildly and have varied wildly in their value. So as a store of value, aren't they very, volatile? And if people are to start using them to save, for example, and I spoke to someone yesterday who is 23 years of age. He believes that Bitcoin is the way of the future. He puts away $100 a week from his pay packet, and he invests this in, buys a fraction portion of Bitcoin, and he hopes to buy a house one day. If you've got fluctuations as we've had with Bitcoin, well, he may be buying a beautiful mansion with a tennis court and a pool, or he may be buying a nothing, tin shed.
Yep, that's absolutely right. But that's also true of government money or fiat currencies. In Australia, we've got a pretty good Australian dollar. It hasn't let us down yet, but lots of countries, Venezuela, for instance, have had their own savings and their own currency destroyed by poor government management. This notion of money is important, and we need it to be not just stable in the sense of it's the unit of purchasing power, but we need it to be a long-term store of value. And traditionally, gold was that. But the reason gold was that was because gold was scarce. Remember, we started this conversation with what is a cryptocurrency? Digital scarcity. It's a way of creating scarcity. So the argument about, you know, what type of money is Bitcoin or a cryptocurrency? And the initial conception of it, Satoshi's vision, was that Bitcoin would be a payments technology, a money that you use for spending. And if that's the case, you definitely want it to be stable as a unit of account. The fluctuations that we have been seeing for the last 13 years, it has fluctuated a lot. It is actually not a very good spending money. As a store of value, it is actually quite incredible. It's daily or weekly or monthly fluctuations. If you zoom right out and just look at the trend, it is a phenomenally powerful store of value. And the reason for that is there's only ever 21 million of them. And that's written in the code. Anyone can see that. It's basically impossible to ever change. You can trust that there will only ever be 21 million Bitcoins, of which 18 million or almost 19 million now are already mined. So there's only 3 million or so left to exist. And that's ever. There will only ever be that many. The last one will be mined in the year 2140 or something like that. So it's now unlike gold, which is, gold is hard to mine, but there's actually quite a lot of it there. And we know that it's in asteroids. And if we keep looking for it, we can find more gold, right? So in that sense, Bitcoin is more scarce than gold. So it's that scarcity element that is providing it as a savings technology. But to your point, that's not the same as a spending technology or a money that we use for transactions every day. And for that, what has emerged actually are stable coins, or this idea of a cryptocurrency that is stable with respect to a fiat money. So most cryptocurrency stable coins are stable with respect to the US dollar. So
Can I ask one question before this?
Yeah.
I know that there are millions of people out there, Jason, that would love to know why a currency is called a fiat currency. The word fiat, most people think it's a car. Yeah. I remember it as being the proclamation that came out of the Roman Senate back in previous history. They would read a fiat. Why is it called a fiat?
Yes, it's a good question. Your history is absolutely right. Fiat is a Latin word, not an Italian word. That's the car company. The translation of the word fiat is by decree. I say it, thus it is. Right. So, fiat currency is the government going, I declare this to be a currency. It is, the value what we'll call government money is often protected by a monopoly privilege. That's legal tender. You must use this as a money because it is the law. Governments will have monopoly rights to print and issue that money. And the way in which, the reason you and I use the Australian dollar, for instance, for when we're buying sandwiches or beer or whatever, is because it's convenient, right? Now, by law, we have to pay our taxes in Australian dollars. The Australian Tax Department will only accept Australian dollars on the way in. So at some point in our yearly lives, we have to accumulate we have to pay the Australian government in fiat, in the money that they insist. So long as we're doing that, we might as well use it for all the other things. So fiat money or a government money is not a money that's backed by anything. It exists and is trusted and is used because the government insists that it is the money that it wants to receive. Use it for payments. So yeah.
Basically, the governor of the Reserve Bank says, this is the Aussie dollar. Yep. I declare it the currency of Australia.
And we will decide how many of them there are and so on. That's the sense in which, so people talk about a fiat currency or a government money as not being backed by anything, and it's not. There's nothing behind it, except the promise of future tax revenue. So you're basically, when you're trusting a government money or a fiat currency, you're not trusting that there's a bunch of gold that they've got in reserve, that if I bring this in, I'll get gold. It's not a commodity-backed money. It's backed by the promise that the government will continue to exist. And the tax department will continue to exist, and the tax system will continue to exist to raise revenue from its citizens and provide public goods. So a fiat currency is essentially a measure of trust in the government and its institutions that provide it. And you know, many governments are worth trusting, not all, but many.
Okay, so let's bring in some vested interests here. So you're saying it's a fiat currency is a trusted currency, and now we have cryptocurrencies, and there's a lot of countries that are affected, their economies and their currencies are affected by, let's say, the US currency. And so the US currently is utilizing quantitative easing for some effects in their own economy, but that has a knock-on detrimental effect to other countries' value of their fiat or sovereign currency. So they go, gee, being tied in some way to the US dollar, and they've decided they're going to use quantitative easing, which is the subject of another podcast, is having an adverse effect on our currency. It would be great for us not to have to put up with American economic policy that's got not a lot to do with us, but it is affecting our currency. Another example, America passes sanctions on countries such as Iran, says you can't trade oil. And I think Iran accounted for 4.5% of all crypto mining, because that was their way of trying to get around the US sanctions. So the vested interests that you were talking about before, there are in fact sovereign nations that have vested interests to want to get into crypto because it releases them from the knock-on effects of what happens with the euro or the US dollar.
I think that's a very good way of describing it. And you know, an economy needs money. And the more stable and independent and trusted that money is, the better the economy works, because the more stable the money is and the more trusted it is, the more I'm willing to write contracts into the future using that money, the more I'm willing to hold that money in exchange. So in a sense, it doesn't matter where we get the money from. We just need a high quality money, which is stable, trusted, that has all of these sort of nice properties. Now, sometimes governments can provide that, but they always have a temptation to cheat, because it's basically they're the only ones with the printing press. So we have there's the one of the reasons we have independent central banks is to try and sort of take the politics out of money and to do that. This is why we have currency unions, for instance, the EU, to create a sort of supranational money that took the quality of the money that was used for trade out of the hands of individual governments. So there's always a tension between the quality of a money that the citizens want versus the quality of the money that the government is willing to provide. And what economic collapse looks like is essentially the citizens losing that fight and the government dealing with its either external debts or paying itself by just abusing the money.
You brought up a fantastic point there. I was in Greece during the economic crisis they had. Greece was on the euro as their currency, so they'd given up their old currency. They were in all sorts of trouble. Had they still been on their old currency, it would have been not worthless, but certainly the exchange rates would have worked so that it was almost worthless, which would have actually been a good thing in many ways, because it's a self-correcting mechanism. And so tourists would have flooded into Greece because it would be dirt cheap to have a holiday. They would have bought lots of things in Greece because it would be a fraction of the cost elsewhere. And that would have helped regenerate the Greek economy, which was in all sorts of trouble. But because Greece had the euro as their currency, they were at the behest of all the other European nations to bail them out and lend them money, which caused all sorts of problems, social problems, political problems. Could that situation have been solved with a cryptocurrency?
Yeah, I was one of the people that was actually calling for Greece to just adopt Bitcoin at that stage when it had its collapse there. But I think, I mean, we're describing two distinct phenomena here. One is the idea of monetary independence and the ability to use the price mechanism to get itself out of trouble, which is exactly how you would have described it. There would have been exports would have flown in, would have flooded in, and so on. But the thing that Greece wasn't able to do because it was on the euro was it wasn't able to set its own prices. It couldn't, and crucially, it couldn't set interest rates within that system. So we either have to have a system where you've got a sovereign money and flexible prices, which is the situation that you described, and that would have self-corrected and gotten itself out. Or we have to have a money system that just simply wasn't able to be corrupted in the first place, or wasn't able to be gamed in the first place. And a lot of the problems that, you know, just to dig into Greece there, a lot of what went wrong there was they were cooking the books, and they were cooking the books because they could. And when it was discovered, so that was a correction rather than a long-term situation. But I think the situation of El Salvador, which you mentioned earlier, adopting Bitcoin as a legal tender is interesting, because that's a different situation. Here you've got a situation where the citizens of a nation just simply don't trust the government. They've abused them before in terms of money. So by handing off power to, instead of, you know, you don't have to trust the native currency, and forgive me for not knowing what that is right now, we're going to use Bitcoin. Me as the sovereign leader of El Salvador, I have no power over that. You, as my, you know, loyal subjects and citizens, can trust that I can't mess with that. We saw the same thing in a different context in sort of Hong Kong, for instance, which pegged its currency to the US dollar. Like, it had a fixed exchange rate of 5 or 7 or whatever it was. And again, that was a signaling mechanism just to say, you know, we're a powerful city state, but we can't, no matter how powerful we are, we can't affect the US foreign policy. We can't affect US monetary policy. Therefore, by pegging our money to that big thing we can't affect, you can trust our money. So whether you peg it to the US dollar, or you peg it to Bitcoin, or you just allow Bitcoin in, you dollarize or Bitcoinize, what is basically going on there is a sovereign signaling, we need a high quality money in this country. If I can't provide it for you, I'm going to offer you're an external option. But either way, we need some kind of way of providing high quality money. Australia, we don't really have that problem. We've got a very high quality central, you know, reserve bank that have you know, more or less led us well in that respect. But not all countries are in those situations.
I hope you're enjoying our chat with distinguished Professor Jason Potts, co-director of RMIT's Blockchain Innovation Hub. In the final part of the Bergenomics series on blockchain, Professor Potts and I discuss the implementation of cryptocurrencies in Australia.